Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Sail Faster, the podcast for those who, as you know, obsess about sailing faster than anybody else. Well, today I've got a terrific guest for you, and that's Scott Nixon. So Scott is a top racing sailor. Many of you will know him or heard of him. He's been involved with yacht racing pretty much his whole life, it seems. He was an All-American sailor at St. Mary's College of Maryland, and he has a really fantastically wide range of racing experience, including dinghies and one design keelboats, inshore big boats, and offshore distance racing. And he's raced regularly with people like Terry Hutchinson and many other top sailors, of course. Scott works for Quantum Sails, and he's worked there, I think, since about 2000. He works primarily on the one design classes. And I thought Scott would be really interesting to have on the pod, not just because of his stellar racing pedigree, but also because of this direct involvement in testing, design, and development of Quantum's One Design sail programs. Scott has sailed with Quantum customers to win championships at the World, Gold Cup, European, North American, and national levels. He actively campaigns and coaches and races in a bewildering variety of classes, including every J from J22 to J111, CNC 30s, FAR 30s, FAR 40s, the NYYC 42, SWAN 45, Melgers 20, 24, 32, 40, and of course the TP52 classes. He's won world championships in the Melgers 32 and J111 classes. So I thought it'd be great to talk to, and he turned out to be exactly that. He is living in Annapolis with his wife Alexis and their daughters Savannah and Summer. I'm really thrilled that he had time to talk to us about everything he's got going on. So here we go. So Scott, good morning. Welcome to Sail Faster. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Good morning. Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it. I've been watching your website grow, and some of the podcasts have been great. So I appreciate all your work you've done. Thank you.
Let's kick off with your current role. You've got this really impressive sounding title of being the Global Offshore One Design Director, which sounds like a dream job. What's that about?
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Well, I've been with Quantum since basically 2000, so it's coming up on almost 25 years now. So obviously when I was younger and out of college and sailing smaller boats, I did a lot of that for the group, and always worked with one design classes and started sailing, you know, J22s and J24s and Melgers 24s, and then it dwarfed into Melgers 20s and 32s and grew into bigger boats. So I always helped Quantum globally. I work for the corporate office, you know, we have affiliates around the world and a good network of lofts. And I work for the corporate company, and I help, you know, develop the tuning guides. I'm kind of a liaison between the guys on the water and the designers. So, you know, I know you sail the J105, so we work with our sail designers and get input from customers and myself, guys that do the sail testing and look at sails on the water and kind of update the product every year and update the tuning guides and kind of make sure the information going out to the group is appropriate.
So I know you, it sounds fascinating, wish I could do that. So I know you go out with customers a lot and sail testing. Are there times when you sort of go out there and you look at a new sail and you think, oh yeah, we need to change that a bit. I can see we should adjust that. Is that, or is that much more sort of computer aided these days?
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, now with the computer programs and the modeling, the top end designers are getting really good, you know, and we take the data from a boat and put in the rig, the hull, the appendages, you know, we've done tests with all that stuff. We can help set up a baseline tuning guide for a boat that hasn't even hit the water yet. So when then we go sailing on the new boat, we can help set up the appropriate capture out tensions, the lower detentions, get the rate correct, and then the sail models get built over those specs. So there's a lot of looking at that, but for sure, when we put sails up, they're not always perfect. So they take a lot of time to get optimized and make sure, you know, the draft's correct and the cambers are right and make sure the sail twist. And the hard thing with the one design sails are, you know, for your J105, you have one mainsail, one jib, and one kite. And obviously we sail in 0 to 30 knots. So those sails need to get through the full range. Obviously, I think for the one design classes, it's important to optimize those sail shapes for that, you know, 6 to 12 knots, which we spend so much time sailing in, but still got to get through the super light ranges and the breezy ranges. And that's where, you know, rig tune comes in to help bend those sails into appropriate shapes for that.
Hmm. Yeah, I realize I'm a quantum boat, quantum house, as it were.
Thanks for staying quantum. We appreciate it.
Yeah, I've got a brand new main that Jason Curry's still got in his office somewhere. So I'm looking forward to unwrapping that. I mean, you've sailed with everybody, like the Terry Hutchinsons and so on. Give us a sense of sort of your career highlights, if you like.
Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously, you know, everybody wants to win world championships and those things. I've won a couple of them and we're trying to win another one this year at the end of the year in the ORC Worlds. But those things take a lot of time and a lot of preparation. And I think when you see people that have won, you know, multiple world championships, you know, not only are they good sailors, they're good preparers and they just, you know, spend a lot of time to achieve those goals. So I think those things have a lot of weight in my mind. You know, it's kind of like the guys that are medalists and do all they work to prepare for that. It's just next level. You know, it's a lot of time. It's a full-time job. So those world championships, North Americans are big events to win. And they take a lot of time. So I'm proud of those moments. And, you know, a lot of the one design classes, the sailing so close and so competitive that every little thing makes a big difference. So the guys that train well and optimize and check all the boxes for sails, boat prep, bottom prep, you know, crew training, do all that stuff to win those events. It really hats off to that.
Yeah, I've talked to, you know, a few people who've been world champions either on wind surface or on dinghies and so on in the series. And it's an obsession. I love that. I've always had a corporate job, so I couldn't get obsessed about it. But it is that meticulous obsession and attention to detail that's quite interesting.
Yeah, it is. I'm a huge Alabama football fan, and I follow, you know, obviously the Nick Saban and Bear Bryant years, and I think Bear Bryant had a famous quote that it was always like, you know, everybody has the will to win. You know, it's the will to prepare to win that really makes a difference for the guys that win and do well. So it's, you know, the more you put in, the better you'll get out of it. You know, the more you train for Wednesday nights and practice and have good, can tack the boat well, drive the boat well, have good spinnaker sets and roundings, you know, tactics don't even count until you can do all that stuff. So it takes time to prepare to have a good result.
Yeah, I was watching your video you did on one design starting process for, I think it's US Sailing. You can find it on YouTube. But you were making that point a few times about those that go out and practice the starts, get out there and practice and practice and practice before every race, every regatta. That's a difference maker. So I thought that was interesting. You start off by saying the next world championship for you is ORC. So it's not one design, it's ORC, is it?
It's ORC, yes, sir. Yep.
What kind of boat are you sailing on for that?
It's a TP52. It's an ORC
52. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You've done quite a lot of TP52, haven't you?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yep, it's a great boat, super close racing. It's basically one design sailing. All the boats are slightly different. You know, they're modified Super Series boats, or our boat was built specifically for the ORC rule. So, you know, sails are optimized for a rating rule, but everybody's bands are so close that the results are within seconds and boat lengths for sure. So it's basically one design sailing.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of it on Instagram and, you know, YouTube. I do follow that. And there's some great mark roundings where I have to rewind a couple of times to say, did they manage to make that tack within the three boat circle with that? Anyway, it's good stuff. So to that point, actually, do you have a favorite? I know you've sailed many different boats, also in many different races, but around the buoys, a long distance racing. Do you have a favorite boat or favorite type of race that you absolutely love?
Yeah, I mean, for racing boats, I really love the one design boats. I mean, for years when the Meldis 24 came out, I always thought that boat was really special, right? It came out in 1992 and was kind of ahead of its time, and it's still a great boat, great design. And, you know, guys are training for the Worlds this summer out in San Francisco, and that boat's still fantastic to sail. It takes four or five people, you know, good coordination. Unlike the J70, it's a pretty physical boat. You still have to hike really hard. So, you know, the younger guys on the rail really you know, earn their money on that, but it's a great boat. The 32, Meldis 32 was one of the boats I really loved back in the day. We had, I think our biggest Worlds was 32 boats, and we had, you know, three pros on the boats and just all the big names in sailing were in that class. That was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that class. Really, really fun sailing.
Who are the most impressive people that you've sailed with?
I've been lucky. I've sailed on a bunch of different boats, over the years. And, some of these larger teams, that have you know, pretty nice budgets, bring in some pretty top names to be tacticians or drivers. You know, I spent a lot of time trimming main or doing runners, also doing tactics on some of the boats. But, you know, over the years, locally here in Annapolis, you know, Terry Hutchinson, obviously still a legend, and I've spent a lot of time sailing with him. He and I owned a Meldis 24 together for a number of years and got to sail with him, and it was really fun. It was back when he was doing some of the earlier cups, and when he wasn't in town, I got to drive the boat. When he showed up, you know, I did tactics and he drove, but he's super impressive. You know, the biggest thing coming away from him when you sail with him is just the level of intensity, and that everything's just brought up to that level. Every little ounce of, you know, jib sheets being shortened by 2 mils to hiking as hard as you can, you know, much longer than you would without him on the boat. I mean, that level of intensity is always there with him, and it's there from the time you leave the dock to the time you get back to the dock. So that's pretty impressive. On the bigger boats, we brought in some great helmsmen over the years. I sailed in the Inner Lodge for a number of years, and Dean Barker came and sailed with us. And
oh, yeah.
He was amazing. Just to see his level of awareness pre-start and the timing. You know, those boats are quite hard to get up to max speed and hit the starting line at angle, at targets, you know, right on the line at speed. And he would do it almost every start, which is really impressive.
Wow.
Currently on our the Fox 52 that I sail on, we have Santiago Long sailing the boat. And he's probably the, I think he's won, you know, 4 or 5 medals. He just was the oldest guy to win a gold medal here at the last games, and his level of awareness and sensitivity on the wheel is just amazing to see those guys sail. But it's all their focus. You know, off the water, they're quite fun, but when they hit the water, they're quite serious. So they spend all their energy on the sailing and racing moments. And when they get off the boat, they relax and go from there. But it's impressive to see how they do that.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of Terry Hutchinson videos where he's obviously got a chest cam or a head cam or something like that, and he's racing the Quantum boat in the TP52 series.
Yep.
And that's just interesting. Just listening to his commentary, what he's, you know, there's not a lot of commentary going on, but.
And that's what's amazing. I mean, those guys, you think they have a narrow view of just doing their job, but they're so aware of, you know, on the 52, you have 13, 14 people on the boat, and he's aware of what every person should be doing, plus seeing the wind coming, plus strategically and tactically knowing where he wants to place the boat and what he wants to achieve with the fleet. So it's impressive to see their minds work that fast. And that's kind of when he's doing those videos and talking through it. It's just, it's pretty next level.
So Scott, earlier we were talking about favorite parts of the course, favorite parts of the race course. And you talked about two areas being the start, and just going back to that great US sailing video, that's really interesting. And then mark rounding, or windward mark rounding. So I'd love to start talking about starting. And I'd love to get your thoughts on your approach. I mean, I know you go with clients a lot in many of the boats, but if you're in charge and it's your boat and you're setting up for the start, take us through what that looks like for you.
Yeah, again, I think, you know, the start's, you know, a big part of the race. I don't know if it's my favorite part of the race. I think when you sail the faster boats, downwind's always the most fun, downwind legs. But, you know, 80% of the race is getting off the line clean and being able to sail and execute your starting plan. That means, you know, starting and going straight, not getting pinched off, not getting flush, and trying to go the way you want to go. But I think the preparation you put in the start's really key. But my philosophy is, you know, on the starting line is to start in least dense areas. So, you know, I see get to sail in the J105 class with you guys a bunch of Wednesday nights. And sometimes those starts are quite game on relative to the other classes because you have so many boats. The starting line's not always square. So anybody who does all their homework, you know, pings the ends of the line with the Velocitech or the Atlas and make sure they know, you know, where the starting line is and spends their time. You know, setting up for the start can really execute a good start. So that's the key, I think, to having a good start is making sure you do all the preparation to get off the line clean. And if you do the low density starts, you know, you're probably not going to round the weather mark top three, but you can round top five, pass a couple boats from there and have a great keeper race. And that's how the big guys and the really good guys and the big fleets win regattas. You know, they're not always rounding first and trying to win the pin if it's favored by 5 or 10 degrees. They might start middle pin, get off the line clean, you know, but execute their start and, you know, sail the shifts and the beat the way they want to.
So Scott, if the line's square, let's say it's square to wind and so on, is a less dense start generally in the middle?
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, I always tell guys when we're doing that and there's a square line, and I think the more you sail with these, I don't know if you've done a lot of sailing with the mark bots, but now the mark bots are out there and the PROs can control these marks on their cell phone, basically. So, you know, they let us know when the pin is set, or a lot of times, like in the Great Lakes fleet, we do a mark bot for the weather end and the lured end. So the line is almost all the time perfectly square until the next shift comes through. So once they get the line set, they tell us they're pingable, line's squared away. But at basically 2 minutes and 30 seconds, I think when you're doing your pre-start loops, you know, your starboard tack loop's normally about 20 to 40 square meters off a line. And then your port tack loop's normally, you know, 40 to 80 square meter or 80 meters off a line. So when you're doing those loops at 2 minutes and 30 seconds, you kind of can see and identify where the starting line is going to be crowded, right? So if you see a lot of guys at 2:30, if you're at the middle of the line and there's more boats to the right of you, the boat end is probably going to be a little more crowded and more dense than the pin end. So that's when you can re-strategize and change your plan from starting at the boat to sliding down the pin for that at least dense start down there.
So could we break down those loops then? Let's start with a port tack loop. I've heard a number of people talk about being just below the pin at 3.5 minutes. And that feels to me, that's a lot of time to burn. Unless, yeah. Not a Wednesday night race where it tends to be a lot crowded and sure. Less room to maneuver. But say on a, you know, Helly Hansen Sailing World nudes type regatta, that feels to me like a lot of time. But I'm interested in how does your loop, your start of the port tack loop, how does that look from your point of view?
Yeah, I mean, I think originally when you're, you know, doing all your homework and you ping the ends and kind of determine, you know, which end is favored, or, you know, say we're sailing Annapolis in the really strong ebb tide and, you know, it's a northerly blowing, you're probably going to be going left. So even if the boat's favored by 10 degrees, you probably want to start to lure to be able to go straight and get out of the current, stay off the channel. So that comes into play when you're doing all that stuff. So at 3 minutes, you would identify kind of where the group or fleet's going to be. And say you figured that, you know, 80% of the boats are to your left pre-start towards the pin end, it's going to be crowded, that you probably would slide up. So that comes into play when you're setting up that pre-start stuff. But as far as timing goes, like say you're going to start at the leeward end, you know, you're normally going to be doing a port approach and you're normally going to be tacking between, you know, 30 and 45 seconds. If you're not doing that, it's going to be hard to start probably 3 or 4 boat lengths up from the pin to the pin end. It's just going to be not executable, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I get it. So you do your final turn to make sort of final approach for the line at 30 seconds to a minute.
Yeah.
The point at which you're directly below the pin for that, does that always just vary, or do you have a standard 2 minutes we want to be at the below the pin? Because that gives us some options.
Yeah, I mean, curious. I think if you listen to a lot of the coaches, like Stephen Hunt and these guys, at 2:30, where their boat is on port tack is kind of where they're going to start, meaning they're going to execute a little further, kind of a semi-Vanderbilt start where they're going to sail down a certain amount of time to get back to that area at the final squeeze, whether that be 30 seconds on starboard or a minute 30 on starboard. But I think identifying the fleet of when they're set up, you know, majority of the boats are going to set up on starboard around, you know, a minute 10 to a minute 45, right? So minute 45 is pretty early to be time and distance, high, slow, killing on starboard tack. So there's lots of opportunity for boats to come in on port, boats to set up to weather that group. So when you identify boats sitting up, you know, at a minute 45 and they're only, you know, four or five lengths off the starting line, they're going to have a hard time hitting that line at full speed. So it's pretty crowded there. So your strategy can change as far as, okay, we're going to do another loop, go back to the pin and do a port approach and tack at 25, 30 seconds and be able to lee bow and put the bow down and start to leeward safely. Or you can dip that group if they're early and slide up the line and start at the right side of them.
Yeah, I like that. That's really interesting. That notion of where you are at 2 minutes 30 is basically where you're going to come back to and where you're going to start. And then you can time it from there, which is interesting. When we were talking earlier, I was surprised at how deep behind the line you like to be. Not, you know, two boat lengths, but Tommy, it was a lot deeper than that, wasn't it?
Yeah. It depends on the fleet. Obviously, you know, we keep bringing up the Wednesday nights because it's such a small line and an aggressive group with the J105s. Guys end up very close to the line. There's always boats over early. And when you watch the drone footage of the start, you know, the next day you're like, oh my God, guys are doing like 3 knots off the starting line when your target's what, 5'8" upwind and 10 knots. So I think the time and distance is really good, but that's where it comes into play. Just the pre-start routine of doing some pinging your ends, knowing your lay lines for the boat and the pin, that comes into play when you're doing port approach if you're starting near the pin, and same with the boat. You know, you don't want to barge and get stuck out of there. I mean, how many times Wednesday night do we see a couple of J105s peeled off into the boat? So knowing your lay line's important, having your pings, knowing how many meters you're off, and then do a couple practice starts And there's like really two big reasons to do the practice darts. One is just to check the accuracy of your pins and your pings when you ping the in with your, you use a pro start, I think, on your boat. So when you ping those ends, you want to be pinging them at, I wouldn't go faster than 4 knots because the GPS is accurate, but not that accurate. So if you're going faster than 4 knots, it's probably not as accurate. So when you ping the ends, you want to be close hauled course at the boat end, you know, right next to the pin, ping that. And then same thing at the leeward end at that pin, you know, ping that, doing 2 to 4 knots. And then when you do a practice start, you want to check to see how accurate you are. So you can start next to the pin and see where your bow is. And if it says, you know, 4 meters off, you might need to reping, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And the other rule of thumb, I'm not sure it's a rule of thumb, but you talked a few times about hitting the line, you know, obviously at speed and on time, which is the idea. But for you, it's being within 2 meters of the line, 2 meters below the line, for you is a good target. So not actually hitting bang on the line, but even being 2 meters below on time, that feels like a good start for you.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good start. And that's why I always like to ping, you know, when you push a button to ping, I always ping, you know, very safe on the leeward side of the flag at the boat or the pin at the leeward end. That way you kind of can have confidence in trying to start at zeros on the pro start, you know, when it does a countdown and your meters are going down quickly. If you don't have a really safe and a confident ping, it's hard to hit those zeros, you know, but general rule of thumb, 30 seconds, 30 meters, you're off to the races and no current. So that's a good rule of thumb to have. So doing some practice starts to figure out how many meters you have to go is pretty good. And just the guys that do it all the time have experience. You know, like if I was doing tactics for you, I would be telling you, okay, we have 10 seconds to burn, you know, we're 10 meters too early right now or something like that, or we're late at 45 seconds in sailing. So really knowing your meters can help you get out of those weird situations that just happen, right? So you're trying to start in a least dense area and somebody comes over last minute on port tack and lee bows you, you know, you probably have to keel high and get your separation off that boat. So knowing your meters to get to the line and knowing when to put the bow down, really important. But hitting that line at full speed 2 meters back is going to be a hard start to beat. You at least be able to execute a good start and go straight and not have to get flushed out of the tack.
The J105, like probably a lot of big keel boats, takes a long time to accelerate to speed. So if you're early, it's quite deadly because then if you have to luff to kill speed, then it'll take a ton of time to reattach speed and
It's really hard. And you look at, you know, when you start watching all these drone videos of our pre-start practices and even off the races, you don't realize how much leeway a boat has. So the one thing that we like to identify pre-start on any boat, whether it's, you know, sailing on the TP with all pros or sailing, you know, the J105 Wednesday night, okay, it's blowing 8 knots. So our minimum boat speed is probably going to be 2 knots. So I don't want you to go under 2 knots because we don't have good boat control with that. We can't defend if we're sitting up on starboard tack, you know, luffing the jib, half trimmed on the main, trying to kill time and distance to get our starts, you know, get off the line clean. If we're below 2 knots, we can't defend. We can't defend a port tacker. We can't drop our bow down. We can't double tack if we had to. So identifying a bottom speed is really important in all that wind range. And then as it gets choppier, you probably need to bump that up, you know, 2.5 knots, 3 knots. And that means, you know, if you're doing 2.5 knots and you're only 2 lengths off the starting line with 30 seconds to go, you're probably too early. So, you know, all that timing comes into play on the start.
I can feel the adrenaline starting to flow as I'm talking about this, as I'm starting to imagine it. Because it is very stressful in those crowded, you know, J105, like every fleet. This is not just obviously a J105 podcast, but J105s probably have similar characteristics to other sort of mid-30s and above keelboats. One rule of thumb I've heard from, again, the J105 fleet is no maneuvers within the last minute. So you've got to be on starboard 60 seconds plus. Because otherwise you but that requires a ton of knowledge and gut feel for what's going to work in those last 30 seconds.
I think that's a good rule of thumb, but I think don't forget your boat speed comes into play with that. So if you're on port tack and doing, you know, if our target in 10 knots is 5-9, 6 knots of boat speed, if you're doing that boat speed on port tack, you have the opportunity to tack on to starboard. You're still going to be fast. And then if there's, you know, a big gap to weather and you're early, you can tack back to port then back to starboard. So it all relates to timing and boat speed. But yeah, if you have good boat speed, you kind of can wiggle out of a lot of situations where if you set up early and are slow, you know, you are that marshmallow waiting to get picked off from a boat coming in from behind or to leeward. So
yeah,
the management of that final distance is really key.
Yeah, I'm already feeling stressed about it already. We're going out with your colleague Jason, I think I said on the weekend, to get some coaching on starting and on his Wednesday night. It's absolutely critical. The other area that we were going to talk about was Windward Mark roundings and setting up for the next leg of the course. I'd love to hear how typically you think through those kind of maneuvers.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think if you break down the whole entire race, I mean, the biggest gains and losses are starting and the mark roundings. You know, other than that, you know, if you're tactically brilliant, hit some big shift, you can pass some boats, or you have great boat speed, you can pass, you know, a couple boats here or there. But those are the big opportunities for gain and the opportunities for loss. So, you know, if you get off a line clean, your mark roundings are probably going to be easier because you're in less traffic, and vice versa. If you have a bad start, you're going to round maybe in a little bit more traffic. So that's where, you know, tactically you have to think ahead of that weather mark rounding. So, you know, when you sail on the big one design fleets, you know, if you're ahead, you kind of want to, obviously the rule of thumb is to get to the ley line, get clear air and get out of there. But when you're behind, that's when it gets difficult, right? The ley line stacks up. So where do you come in? How do you approach? You know, it's easy to come in from the port tack approach and come in from clear air, but that's a very, you know, dangerous situation as you get to the top of the course. But a general rule of thumb with, you know, the longer legs, Sailing World Regatta is coming up and it'll be what, a mile and a quarter, mile and a half leg if there's good breeze. And if you start leeward in the line and go straight off the line, you're probably going to be approaching the weather mark from the left side and vice versa. If you started the boat, potentially you're tacking out early. So you're probably going to be approaching the weather mark from the right side. So you know, if you're approaching from the right side, the danger is, you know, the ley lines as far as overstanding. If you approach from the port side, obviously the danger is, you know, entering inside the zone and being able to tacking boat that fouls out. So picking your spot through the starboard tack ley line is really important from there. So the one thing that kind of comes into play a lot of times is guys, when they're behind, try to get to ley line pretty early, but it looks good. You tack the ley line, but then you have 5-10 boats ahead of you, and guess where they're going to tack? Right on the ley line. So you're sitting in bad air. So that final approach of thinking it through, not just one step ahead, but two steps ahead of how to keep that air clear on both starboard and port. So a lot of times you end up tacking, you know, the smart guys that are behind will tack, you know, 5, 6, 10 lengths inside the starboard lay, have a clear or somewhat clear lane to be able to stay close to their targets, close to boat speed, so the losses are minimalized so they can get back in there and just round with the group and work on passing boats on the next leg.
Yeah, I've heard that people talk about a hidden lane being inside the starboard lay line. But so if you've got clear air and probably some decision making there because you haven't committed to being on the ley line, but as you get close to the mark, the risks start to increase because now you've got to tack twice, so you've got to find that hole. And if that starboard ley line gets more and more crowded, you're now a little, you could be potentially a little bit trapped below the ley line,
and that takes some awareness to watch to see where that ley line is. You know, if it's obviously a right favored track or there's some right shift going on or more pressure, right, obviously the starboard tack ley line will stack up quite early. And if it's a left-handed track, obviously it's a little more clear over there. So just having some patience and seeing where it is. But obviously, you know, we talked about the least density starting areas. And normally if you have a good start, if the boat's favored by 10 degrees and you start middle or pin in, you're going to be in clear air for a long time. And so when the starboard tack boats tack on that left shift, you know, you have the ability to sail into it for, you know, 30 seconds, tack over, and you could have a clear lane on port for a long time. So that sets up the approach, really. I mean, right after the starting line, halfway up the beat, you're thinking about your approach to the weather mark, and that's really the key to either, you know, minimizing losses or gaining on that leg. It's really important.
So what I thought, you know, we did in our first year, sometimes we got to the ley line, the starboard ley line too early, but it did create this sort of sense of relief in terms of, okay, we're on the ley line. Great. We can see the mark. We're going to hit it. But you do lose that tactical flexibility, but also a wind shift comes in and you lose that, obviously. And then it just gets crowded. So then you're in air, then you're sort of down.
The biggest thing about ley line management is you're sailing extra distance, you know. So when you analyze after the race, a lot of guys, you know, have the trackers on board and can see the data. But I would be willing to bet 9 times out of 10, the boats that sail the shortest distance end up, you know, podium or for sure winning the race because it's just they're sailing shorter distance. So when you overstand, you're adding the meters to your overall distance. So it's normally not as good. So you have to identify whether it's worth sitting, sailing extra distance to sail in clear air. You know, normally in my experience in super light air, sometimes it's worth the sail a little bit past ley line, be able to put the bow down, sail at least at target speed or over target speed. But other than that, super light air, you're normally sailing extra distance quite hard. But there's also the tack count, right? In a J105, you're probably losing two lengths to a guy that doesn't tack, maybe more. In chop, you're probably losing four lengths. So you had two extra tacks. There's potentially eight lengths that you're giving up on that beat. So tacks need to count, and you need to put them in the right spot. So it's important to be able to execute good tacks and put them in the right spot, because it is a loss of tacks.
We talked a little bit, we mentioned sort of the offset as well, which is common to many classes, obviously boats. Talking to Christy Robinson earlier in the season, she talked about that as being a zone of opportunity, because if you're drilled and you've got everybody's coordinated, you can really catch boats during the offset.
She's absolutely right. I mean, we have a coach that always says basically the offset leg is free boat lengths, meaning if you sail that well, a lot of people don't put a lot of time or effort into the setup of the weather mark, the offset leg, and that really sets up your spinnaker hoist and your whole downwind leg. So basically, if we're coming in on the port tack and do a slam tack just outside the zone and we round the weather mark at 3 knots and, 10 knots of breeze, where we should be doing, 6 knots upwind, we're almost set up for failure, right? Because boats behind doing that target are going to push into us on the offset leg. So it's going to be really hard for us to get to the offset leg, not have, no overlaps, and have a clear spinnaker set to be able to get that kite clear and get down the run. So that whole setup is really important. But, as you go on the offset leg, you're really thinking about, before you get there, hopefully the tactician has thought about what the plan is on the run, right? If it's a pretty square run, and the right side's favored upwind, you might be doing a jibe pretty early. So you wouldn't want to do a high spinnaker set and really waste distance that way. And meaning if it's a super square course and you're happy nobody's behind you and you have a really good offset leg, you're probably just going to do a normal VMG bearaway where you get the kite up, get the boat speed target, and get the boat down as deep as possible. In the J105, we start sailing weather heel and easing that spinnaker and getting really deep angles. So to do that, you need to have a nice offset leg that sets that up. The biggest thing to me on the offset is that whole turn. A lot of guys round the weather mark and just aim straight at the offset. But really, if you do that, think about it, you can't set your spinnaker until your bow's past the mark.
I do that.
So you really want to aim a length and a half, two lengths above the offset. And that's going to give your bow team opportunity. So when you drop the bow to bear away, the apparent winning angle goes aft, right? So the tactician can call hoist or the helmsman can call hoist. So with a good mark rounding, with a person aiming two lengths above the offset leg, they can get their spinnaker up and drawing, and the stern is just at the offset. Where if you just aim straight at the offset and go for a hoist, you're going to be 2 to 4 lengths past the offset leg before your spinnaker's up and drawing. So that whole setup is really important to think it through.
That's really interesting because, again, being quite a naive driver, I've always had that philosophy, I say it always, the last couple of years, of being close enough to each of the marks that you could touch it, whether upwind or downwind, obviously without losing too much speed. But that's really interesting. I can see why you'd want to stay above the...
So if you get your kite up earlier, you're going to separate from the guys behind you and help tactically. It helps you be able to go straight or sail deeper or jibe, depending on tactic, what you're doing. And the guys in front of you may have rounded a bunch of traffic and they're fighting high. If you have a great set, you could gain, some of those lengths back they did a couple extra tacks with downwind. So it's important.
So that rule holds whether you're doing a jibe set or a bearaway set.
Yeah, even more so in the jibe set, right? Because the jibe set, you got a lot going on. Basically, you can hoist the spinnaker, a little bit earlier because you turn into a jibe right away. But, the whole key to that on the offset leg is making sure you've broken the overlap with the guy behind you, right? If you have a boat inside you, behind you, then obviously he has room, room to... has rights to room there, so you have to give them an opportunity. So,
For me, the bear away always feels like a lower risk, more conservative strategy. And I know that you have to think about what was the lift attack coming into the leg, and so I know all that, right? But yep. It's for me, it's missing that first shift may be less risky than you know, fucking up a drive. If we do fuck up a drive chat, it's on the driver. It's not on my crew who are really good.
Yeah. Well, there's really four sets that are really important to execute. So there's the normal bearaway VMG, meaning there's nobody around you. You aim two lengths high of the offset. You have a nice clean set, jib gets furled, kites up and drawing. You're sailing, you know, your deep target angles right away. Then there's the high set, meaning, you know, you're rounding in traffic or boats behind you, that if you did a normal VMG rounding and sailed down and a guy stayed high, he's going to get into your air, right? So the high set would mean, you know, you're only going to bear away to just above your target downwind angle and get the spinnaker up, and the, you know, the trimmer's going to have a sheet on a little bit more. Maybe your jib stays out longer. You get the boat moving until your lane gets cleared. Then you can drop the bow. Or a low set, meaning you're round behind a group and you know everybody's going to be jibing soon. So you're going to set and sail, you know, at least no higher than your VMG target angle, if not a little bit lower. So when those guys get set up to jibe, you can jibe on them and pass them. And then obviously, you know, the jibe set we talked about, meaning if there's, that's normally a good move. If there's 10 to 15 degree right shift upwind, you're probably, a jibe set would be pretty strong.
Mm. Yeah. One thing I did learn last year was don't be in the middle. So when people are jibing in light wind conditions, as we seem to get quite a lot on the Chesapeake Bay off Annapolis, you know, I've been stuck in that position again, purely my stupid driving, and then people just sail past, and it's just
No, it's frustrating when you're in the middle and guys are behind, and then as you sail in the back of their fleet, you know, biggest thing I always find is it's hard for those guys. You're going to be around boats that aren't sailing the correct angle. So if you're around in the back of the pack and they might be sailing, you know, 5-10 degrees higher than, you know, Ray Wolf, who rounded first, is in clear air and has weather heel, you know, you're going to be sailing extra distance just because you're in the back of the pack. So maybe an early jibe, getting out on your own and sailing your angles, will help you gain boats and gain meters back to the leaders.
That's, you know, you're saying so many interesting things here. I'm going to go back and listen to this and write all this down. So do you find then that the back of the fleet tends not to do a jibe set? On average, I mean, I know unless we have to do a jibe set because we have to be over there for some reason, but
yeah, I mean, I think it's probably wind speed dependent, right? And when it's light air on like Wednesday nights, a lot of time when we round that R2, sometimes the faster angle and the shortest distance is on port jibe straight back into the Severn River. So, you know, executing the jibe suit there is pretty important. But as it gets windier, it's a harder maneuver, right? So if you haven't practiced it, it's going to get tangled. So, you know, you need to make sure you're sorted on that.
Hey, Scott, so the sort of the whole point of this series was about sailing faster, obviously, which is the quest that all of us are obsessive about. How do you go about ensuring that, whether it's your own boat or whether you're sailing with clients and so on, how do you go about ensuring maximum boat speed?
Yeah, I think getting to target speeds is really important. And how do you do that? I think, you know, everybody and even the good guys that spend a lot of time practicing and training and sail testing and tuning, you know, unless you do a really good job in going through your boat and making sure everything is marked, meaning your jib leads, your traveler, marking your jib sheets. You know, we're weather sheeting now a lot in the J105, so making sure your weather sheet is marked so you can see how much weather sheet you have on. Obviously, knowing where the leads are, knowing your backstay tension number, on your little batten with colored tape or a pressure gauge or load cell, whatever you have there to know those settings. And when you're going well, documenting those settings so you can always get back to that. A lot of guys, you know, sail freelance. You can get going fast at times, but, you know, as you know, crew rotates through the boat. You may have different trimmer or guys have different philosophy, or you learn something from somebody new coming on your boat. You know, you want to be able to record those settings and repeat that and get the boat faster that way.
What's your ideal way of marking it? Just through a marker pen, or do you put tape on? Or
yeah, I mean, obviously the simple way to do it is just a Sharpie pen on the boat. And you know, on the jib tracks, you would number each hole. So starting forward would be, you know, your max forward hole to me would be 0. And then as you go back, you know, all the way to 5, 10, whatever your jib leads are. And same thing on your, where the jib sheet comes to the winch or the block, you know, having a number grid there. Sometimes you can buy those deck stickers, you know, Quantum has them. A lot of guys sell them.
Yeah.
You can stick those to your boat. So you have a same thing. You have a number grid system. And then I like to mark the sheets with a couple different colors or some orange insignia tape from your sailmaker, stick that on the sheet. So you can always see, you know, where the jib's going. As a helmsman, if you're driving the boat, it's nice to be able to, okay, we're going really well. and I see the jib might be trimmed a little bit tighter than we normally do, it's probably a good thing. And you wouldn't notice that unless you had marks on the sheet. You know, you're not to leeward looking at your leads, making sure your top telltale's flying, seeing how tight it is. It's really important. And then if you ever bring in a coach, you know, he comes behind you and he tells you to tighten your jib sheet up 2 inches. If you don't have it marked, you know, you're just randomly pulling on the jib sheet. So when you learn something good or bad, it's nice to know where you are. So it's really important.
I've got one. I've got one additional question to ask you. When I think about it, wing on wing is something that some of the J105 drivers in Annapolis are, or boats in Annapolis are starting to look at. Any thoughts on wing on wing? And if when you do it, talk us through what you're looking for, because it, you know, you're sailing by the lee some of the time when you do that. It's quite tricky.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, people don't realize the reason wing and wing came onto these, you know, J boats and the smaller sport boats is guys were doing a lot of testing and doing small course racing. And basically, you know, a couple boats started going to the wing because the leeward legs, the track was so short and so small that it's literally the best VMG and almost the same target speed. So those boats started winning the races and people were like, wait a second, we need to sort this out. I remember we did the J111 Worlds. We won in 2015, I think, and our coach was Ed Adams, and we were winning the distance race by quite a bit, and he made us practice wing and wing, and we were back in those days, we were scared to use it during the windward leeward races because it's, you know, it's a little high skill level. The helmsman has to drive really smoothly, really well. With a wheel, it's quite hard to do wing and wing because there's a little delay there in the steering, you know. The helmsman's trying to keep the Windex dead astern on the rudder. The trimmer's trying to keep the clue out, you know, to leeward so the sail doesn't break. And then you have to sail the boat to the break. But we never really did it in the windward leeward races. And we were winning one of the distance races by a nice little distance and I missed the lay line. So I'm like, all right, let's go to the wing. We went to the wing and we doubled our distance and we won the race and got to the thing. And he just comes up to us and starts yelling at us. I told you to go wing and wing this whole regatta, but it's quite good VMG, but it's tricky, right? If you have you know, bad air behind, it's really hard to keep it full, but it's a strong move, but it needs to be practiced for sure.
Yeah. Also, I think I learned from, I think it was Doug Strike who talked about the fact that it can enable you to stay on starboard, even though you're, you know, heading away, and tactically sometimes that's useful.
There's two ways to look at it. If you sail J70s, you know, that class has gotten so big and so many boats that a lot of times, you know, in the 8 to 16 knot range, over half the fleet's going to be on the wing. It's just the best VMG.
Oh, wow.
But how do you get in that spot is key. You know, if you round in a group and nobody else is on the wing and you all of a sudden go to the wing, you get to leeward of that group and maybe the group behind you sailing high, you get into an area where you're clear air longer. So a lot of times the wing comes into play as far as just clearing your air behind.
Yeah.
So that's pretty important. And then the other time it's used is, we call it no man's land, coming in, you know, middle of the gates. You're not really laying starboard gate or left gate. You can flip the boat to the wing and kind of get to one of the gates by being on the wing.
Hmm. Yeah, we'll try it. I'm going to make sure that my crew hear that point you made about it being very difficult to drive.
Yes, for sure.
Well, I'm sorry to say that's where my conversation with Scott actually ended because my bloody Wi-Fi dropped. So... Well, that's actually where my conversation with Scott ended because my Wi-Fi dropped out. And so I wasn't able to. Well, at that point, that was the end of the conversation with Scott because my Wi-Fi dropped out, which was a bit unfortunate. So he couldn't hear me. I couldn't hear him. So, oh, well, we had covered a lot of ground. And I thought it was a fantastic conversation. I learned a ton. I hope you did, too. Hope you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for listening. I'm sure you have all subscribed to Sail Faster wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or go to www.sailfaster.net if you haven't and sign up there. Thanks for listening as always. Thanks to Scott for joining us. Take care, everybody, and see you all on the water.